Now, one of my all-time favourite plays was written by Edmund Ross Stand and then translated, thankfully, to English by Anthony Burgess, first in 1971 and then again in a very magnificent way in 1985. That is the one that I like best. And Sir Arnaud de Bergerac, by Edmund Ross Stand, contains all kinds of wonderful and marvellous poems. I want to begin today by telling you about one of them, one that was particularly important to me, and I found to be significant. I believe my PowerPoint is coming on, because I have a picture of Cyrano as an illustration from Ross Stand's original. There he is. For those of you who don't know the story, Cyrano de Bergerac was a Gascony cadet, a soldier for France, and he fought the Spanish when there was a war between France and Spain. And he was a passionate and incredible poet. He also had a very big nose. And that large nose meant that he considered himself to be repulsive to people. And it changed the way he lived his life, especially when he fell in love. If you've not ever read the story or seen one of the many films about it, I recommend it to you heartily. It's quite beautiful. I want to take you to a specific scene. The French are under siege. The army is holed up in a small area and they're starving. And the Spanish are eating heartily and having them surrounded. And they're getting weaker and weaker and tempers are frayed. And that pressure that comes in when you are at war really sets in hard. And late one night, one of the men sees a rat scampering around. Like lightning, he thumps it with the back end of his pistol and manages to kill it. Then he gets up as quietly as he can. He skins this rat, puts it on a stick, and he starts trying to roast it. But of course, there's a crackling and there's the smell of cooking meat, and other people wake up, and in an instant there's a riot. People are falling over themselves to try and get hold of this rat, to try to eat a bit of this rat. And in the midst of this furore, Serrano wakes up and he grabs hold of the flute player from the brigade. And he says, quickly, quickly, play the flute. And so in the midst of this chaos, all of a sudden, you hear a beautiful sound. The flute starts to play. And all of the men stop fighting. And they turn, and they look at this flute player. And Serrano says some words. Some of the most beautiful poetry. I hope you don't mind my reading it to you. But the flute plays as the men stand amazed at the beauty of the flute, having just been fighting for this rat. Serrano says to the flute player, play old country airs, with plaintive rhythm recurring, where lurk sweet echoes of the dear home voices, each note of which calls like a little sister. Those airs slow, slow ascending as the smoke wreaths rise from the hearthstones of our native hamlets. Make us a music, pastoral days recalling, the soul time of your youth in country pastures. Hark to the music, Gascons. Tis no longer the piercing pipe of the cat. Beneath his fingers, the flute of the woods. No more the call to combat. Tis now the love song of the wandering goat herds. Hark, tis the valley, the wetlands, the forest, the sunburned shepherd boy with scarlet bearing, the dusk of evening on the Doyle River. Tis Gascony. Hark, tis the music. And as they listen, first to the flute and then to the poetry, they begin to cry, The flute player stops. He looks at Serrano and he says, "They're crying." And he says, "We're homeseekers." And then he winks at him and says, "A far more noble hunger." And then the next day he plays a battle. I find it gives me goosebumps. In fact, if you can't hear and see, I have goosebumps. I find that the whole thing is so beautiful. And it's so biblical. It's so incredibly biblical in what it does. God does this time again. You can read through the Old Testament. David, with his harp and his beautiful poetry, that all of a sudden some awful incident could be stopped by music, then rendered different by poetry. And Paul does just the same here. In the passage that we have read to us, he begins by grabbing everyone's attention. The music, in a sense, starts playing. And then Paul rolls into some of the most beautiful poetry that you will read in the New Testament. My goodness me, can you ever tire of hearing those words? "Rejoice in the Lord always, I will say again, rejoice," and on he goes in a beautiful flow. What I want to say to you is that God uses the flute and the poetry. Paul employs it in a difficult situation that he finds this particular part of the Philippian church facing. Because sometimes groups of Christians have tough times. Sometimes things go badly for a group of Christians, and you need to hear the flute and you need to hear the poetry of what the Lord is saying. Let me give you some examples. If I might just turn to Corinthians. Listen to what Paul says. He says, "In the following directives, I have no praise for you, for your meetings do more harm than good." What a statement. When you get together, it's worse than if you didn't. And you're meant to get together. Poor Corinthians, they were getting all sorts wrong. Paul says something unusual. He says, "In the first place, I hear that when you come together as a church, there are divisions among you. And I believe it. No doubt, there have to be differences among you to show which of you have God's approval." It's a fascinating statement. Paul says, obviously, if there's a row, there is a right and a wrong. Sometimes. Sometimes there's just a whole ball of wrong. Sometimes there's a right and a wrong. And sometimes when things go badly, we pick up on that. Sometimes, and I've experienced it many times myself, I've been vehement about something. But in fact, what God has been doing through my brothers and sisters has been chipping away at something within me and changing me to be more in line with what God is doing. And that can happen to all of us. When I was a new Christian, a young lady explained to me once, she said, "If you imagine there are loads of things that Christians are meant to do, and we're all in different places in our abilities, in different ones." So she said, "When we all get together, you might be brilliant at one thing, and you might be inspirational, God might be using you. You might be dreadful at something else. God is calling us all together to encourage each other and build each other up." So sometimes we fall short. I like that picture. The finish line there is the chap with his hands just short of it. Sometimes we fall short. Sometimes when we wrestle with difficult things, it is because God, in his wisdom, chooses to give us each a piece of the puzzle of his will. Sometimes we get a part of what God is saying, but we don't get it all. And it's only through meeting together, wrestling with difficult issues, that we actually lay hands on the fullness of what the Lord has planned. So those would be positive examples of disagreement, perhaps. The negative examples certainly include the church of Corinthians, the church of Corinth, I should say, who Paul was writing two letters to. They did all kinds of things that were wrong. For example, they took the communion and they turned it into a party. And Paul gives a very rich description of it. He says, let me describe your communions and then I'll tell you how it should be. He said, with your communions, all of the wealthy come along to get drunk and have a feast. And they treat it like a big party. And all the poor come along in the hope of getting some food. All of this is wrong. And Paul separates it out. His communion should be communion. You should be recognizing the body and blood of Christ. And that should be the absolute pinnacle thing that is taking place in communion. And he goes on to say how shameful it is that they are poor. They should be cared for and loved. How shameful it is that something so precious given by God should be turned into debauchery. So he is very stern and clear. Another example that I remember of something which I felt was a very difficult issue, a very painful issue, was back in 2005 when the Southern Baptists convention split away from the Baptist World Alliance. And I remember the issue was over the recognition of women in ministry. And that was a very contentious thing at the time. And the Southern Baptist Convention said, if the BWA recognizes women's role in ministry, then we will not be with you. And I remember a marvelous speech given by President Jimmy Carter, who stood up and spoke with eloquence and with wisdom, and he gave very solid scriptural arguments for both points of view. And at the end of it all, he said, it's okay for us to believe different things on this. Salvation does not hang on it. It's more important for us to be together. And that's how he did it. He said, this issue is here, but the unity of the World Alliance is more important. It's a very interesting talk. It was to no avail on that occasion. But in both circumstances, flute and poetry can be a blessing. As you enter into the scriptures, you hear the flute, you hear the poetry, it can move, it can change hearts. The Lord does use it. So I want to now just have a little look at this passage, this famous passage, and see just how Paul does it. Perhaps it can be an inspiration for us, or for us, in our day-to-day lives as a church, but also as we go out from the church to bring the poetry, to bring the flute playing into the world. So first of all, when you play the flute, everyone hears the flute. Everyone knows Sean's playing the flute today. Thank you, Sean. It's because the flute is loud and clear. If someone is playing the flute, it's hard to hide it. You need a soundproof boom. This is why Serrano picked it. It's loud and clear. And Paul begins loud and clear. He says in verse 2, I plead with you earlier, and I plead with Syntyche to agree with each other in the Lord. The thing to remember is that this lady Euodia, this lady Syntyche, are sitting listening to Paul's letter being read. So it's one of those moments which is probably one embarrassing for them. Because out of the whole congregation, Paul picks them out. Just, hey, you two, sort it out. Paul doesn't deal in whispering. He doesn't deal in subterfuge. He doesn't keep things under wraps and hidden and bedded down. The flute is loud and the flute is clear. And it's out in the open. This is how Paul begins. And it starts to take effect. I even have a picture of an old flute for us to reflect upon. The flute takes effect. Listen to what Paul does next. He says, yes, and I ask you, your loyal yoke fellow, could also just be a guy called Cyzicus, but it might be someone specifically Paul has written to, help these women who have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers, whose names are in the book of life. Paul recalls Christian goings-on with Euodia and Syntyche. He said, they've ministered alongside me. We've been shoulder to shoulder, and it breaks my heart that there's something wrong. It's a remarkable statement to make. And it made me stop and think how wonderful it is when you've actually got good stuff to look back on. It's wonderful if you have labored in the Lord and you work hard, shoulder to shoulder, with your Christian brothers and sisters. It's something about doing stuff for Jesus that the recalling of it is a great blessing. A few years back now, we felt the Lord give us this real clear guidance to do a barbecue for the students at the UEA. We did it in January. It was minus 6 degrees, and it was on a beach on the east coast of England with the Siberian winds blowing in. We said, Lord, are you sure? It was one of the most incredible experiences of my entire Christian life. I mentioned it to you about a year or two ago, I believe. My friend Helen said to me afterwards, she said, if you died now, at least you'd be involved in something wonderful. I said, oh, thanks a lot, Helen. Lord, I don't want to shuffle off this mortal coil immediately. It's great, we got that colossal bonfire, and we got about 200 students, only about 60 of them were Christians. They all came down, we had three bands. It was a remarkable night. I had the huge privilege of sharing the good news. And it's so cold, it was a completely captive audience. If you got more than 6 feet from the fire, you would die. It was as simple as that. Die. We were overwhelmed. And I remember as it all finished, there were people wide apart. We, as a health and safety thing, had to have some people on the perimeter, so to speak, to make sure everyone was okay. And when everyone got back on the coaches, and they all went back to Norwich, and we were standing on the beach, and the fire was just endless. We all gathered around it. There was a young man, I remember him. He was a soldier, and he had been deployed to active combat the very next week. And a local man had hired him to help us out in the setup and to move the generators and all this kind of thing. And at the end of it all, he didn't go because he was helping to tidy up. We all felt we should pray. We joined hands around that fire, around those glowing embers on that freezing night. He turned to this man and said, come and join with us. We started praying for him. I remember him falling to his knees, and us gathering around him, laying hands on him, praying for him. God just kept working. God does these incredible things. He sort of says, do you want more? Do you want some more? Because I've got more. Oh, it's wonderful. And I felt with my brothers and sisters that we were kind of bound together in that moment. Paul says it to you only in the Syntyche. He says, remember where we were. Remember the things that we did, that God used us for. Surely that starts to change your heart. However, there's a problem. In reminiscing, if there's nothing there, we have to actually be dynamically seeking what God is asking us to do and be about his business. Church in no way works as a social club. It's lame. There are better social clubs. But it is the greatest thrill, the most wonderful thing in the world if it is a dynamic, working group of men and women tirelessly serving the Lord, constantly seeking his will, rejecting all that is not his will. And then the poetry really begins. Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. There's much to be happy about. There's a difference between joy and happiness. The minister once put it like this, he loved trains. And he spoke like that. He was my predecessor, Neil Walker. in the last church, that was a good impression that would have got Norton Lennon. But my dear friends, you don't know who he was. Take my word, that was a grand impression. He loved trains. And he said, when he saw this particular train that was wonderful, he was happy. When he was allowed to get on it, he was even happier. When he was told to get off it and it went away, he was sad. But rejoicing and joy itself is not so fleeting. When you give your life to Christ, when the most important thing in your life has a tick next to it, that you are forgiven, that you are saved, that you are welcomed as a child of God Himself, when all of those things are ticked into your life, even if you don't always perceive it, comes a joy that can't be shaken. You can be hugely depressed and joyful. Strange, isn't it? But the joy is a deep thing. Paul reminds them of it, rejoice. And then in verse 5, he says, let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Gentleness. How wonderful that this is heralded as a good thing. To be gentle, to be kind, to be loving. And then in verse 6, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and petition, be thankful and present your requests to God. The emphasis on prayer and everything. Just imagine, Theresa May is not God. She is an important person in our country, but she does not have the authority of the Lord Himself, of course. The Lord is infinitely greater. Just imagine if you have the ear of Theresa May. Just imagine if you could discuss things with her. You might think that was a pretty good thing. We said that in Cambridge. Maybe half a dozen of you already do that. It goes without saying, doesn't it? A few nights ago, a chap came in who was one of her advisors, so it could easily be the case. Just imagine if you've got the ear of the Prime Minister, and then you say to her, "Now, I was a bit concerned about which socks to buy." You might think that was an odd thing to do. You might think, well, I won't bother the Prime Minister with my sock choice. I can work that out on my money. No help with that. That's not a part of my relationship with the Prime Minister. With the Prime Minister, we talk about important things. Then we talk about socks with whoever. But what Paul says is, with God, it is everything. Do I buy brown shoes, Lord, or do I buy white? Should I buy those little socks that are meant to be invisible in your deaf shoes? No, because they keep coming off. They're the most annoying things ever. I wish I listened to the Lord more clearly. There's something remarkable about prayer. There's nothing too small to take to the Lord. And it's poetic. It's beautiful in everything that can come to Him. It's just beautiful. And then in verse 7, peace. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. What a statement. Paul says you will never understand. The peace that God gives transcends. It is greater than the things we understand. We might understand peace in terms of the opposite of war. We might understand peace in terms of a holiday. We might understand peace in terms of a favourite bit of the garden that we like to go in. We might understand peace in terms of no more rows. The peace of God transcends all understanding and is accessed through those things. Through reaching out for the joy that God has already given me, that is already there. Prayer, through gentleness of being. And Paul finishes, of course, with these two great practical responses. Where he says, finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, in fact, if anything is excellent, or praiseworthy, think about such things. Bedeck your mind with good things, rather than filling your mind with utter filth, and horrors, and unpleasant words. And his final piece of practical advice, when he says, whatever you have learned or received or heard from me, or seen in me, put into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. Paul says, as someone who was alive physically when he wrote that, just look to me. Look to your fellow Christians, he says. I'm always worried when we do a discipleship course, because it's a classic example of us putting something in a box, isn't it? We say to a group of people after they're baptized, right, we're going to do a discipleship course. And then someone might come up to them and say, have you done a discipleship course? And they say, yes, I've done discipleship. Discipleship, tick. But it isn't like that. This is discipleship. When we stop in just a moment and we go and enjoy a coffee and a tea and a conversation, our Christian conversations with our brothers and sisters is discipleship. When in the week you get together with a Christian friend, you hang out and you just have a great time, and your conversation quite naturally turns to the things of the Lord, there is discipleship. Discipleship is an ongoing thing, and Paul quite rightly suggests that his brothers and sisters look to him, or look to each other, to see good examples of how to live a Christian life. And that's something we need to learn to do for each other. And so, dear friends, a second look, second bite of the cherry, so to speak, as we look at our passage for the year. And I would encourage you all, it's written always on lots of the literature that we put out because it's on the year's passage, but dwell in it. It is crucial, and it has both the flute and the poetry of our wonderful Lord, John.